Commander Rephard, reel 27. Now, how exactly did you try and get your ship's company into shape? Was this your responsibility as
I was responsible for working the seaman department. As the commander, I was second in command of the ship, and specifically responsible for all the sailors, as opposed to the engine room, the electrical people, and all the other people who were specialists. Now, in order to do that, I wanted to challenge the ship's company as people, as individuals, and to back up the senior ratings, especially in my department, in whatever the challenges were they were trying to get through. As we spent a few days, of course, down Plymouth, finding out which end of the ropes went where and where everything was stowed, we were approaching the Navy days, which occurred in August, when ships were open to the public, of course, the Queen's Navy, available to the people who paid for it, in effect. And by then, we'd had Harold Wilson had come down to be introduced and to make a point, because here we were commissioning before going abroad. And I have a photograph of him doing the thing that politicians do, squeezing the flesh and so on, where I introduced him to the other officers. Why the captain wasn't doing it, I'm not quite sure, but he wasn't. And as we approached the Navy days themselves, the people responsible for the dockyard, therefore for us, before we actually sailed, wanted to know if we were going to join in, and if so, how. And so I said, well, the ship would be open to visitors, of course, and we'd have all the facilities for them on board and special things for children. But I thought it'd be rather fun, as we were going to cross the equator on the way out, if I could run a crossing the line ceremony. And in order to show the public what a crossing the line ceremony was. And this was thought to be a very good idea, to make a big thing about it in the program of the Navy days. And so I duly laid that on, but I wanted to demonstrate that I was prepared to make one in throwing myself into this. So I volunteered to be the first person pulled out of the crowd and ducked in the swimming pool and lathered and shaved and all the other things by Neptune. And I also wanted to involve the crowd by arranging for someone to be pulled out of the crowd, a girl preferably. And I found that one of the sailors' girlfriends had a great deal of spunk and get up and go and was prepared to volunteer to fight like a cat and be hauled out of the crowd and tossed into the canvas swimming pool, which was about 5 feet deep, where the bears and the people would cover her with all the things they do. And she was so good at screaming blue murder that the public who were there watching were saying, oh, it's a bit rough. No, come on, she doesn't want to do it. But nevertheless, we went through with it. And I had arranged that her boyfriend, and indeed she, when she had my steward look after her and give her a chance to change in my cabin and so on, I gave them a tot of whiskey each, which they fully appreciated. And it went down beautifully. Now, that was a way, one of two ways, of getting the sailors, my seamen behind me, because I was prepared to volunteer to be chucked in too, and I was prepared to bring everybody else into it and get a great deal of publicity for the ship. And the we also took ship sea for Families Day, so many of the families that we could possibly get down there for it came to see when we were going to and fro over the degaussing range a few miles out from Devonport. And they loved it. My family came too, of course, and I thought it was very important for the families to mix up without being officers and ratings families particularly. So they were being shown around and so on at sea. But the time was coming when our departure date was actually going to come. And as we went down the Hammers and out into the sound, family waving from the shore. Very emotive thing. We were going away for 18 months. And the pre-war sailors would say, what, only 18 months? I did 3 years in the Far East or something, or 3 years in the Red Sea. But now they don't go for more than about 6 months, versus hell to pay.
And when was the send-off?
August 59. And during the last couple of months, I was spending an hour or two at least a day on welfare cases, because a number of wives were representing that their particular husbands really shouldn't go on a foreign commission. They were needed at home for every reason under the sun. And I had to spend a lot of time on welfare matters. And some of the individual cases were heartrending, and I would get the Soldiers' Service and Air Force Association people out in the sticks to go and visit them and check up on the facts. And in other cases, I had the weeping women appearing down on board the ship, which was more difficult to handle, of course. But as we went down the Hermes, one of the sailormen, I think it was, he was up on the bridge structure somewhere, who had been a total pain in the neck, and his wife was clearly going to commit suicide if he went, and the children would all, you know, be sold to slavery or something, said to him, "Oh, thank God we're underway at last, sir. That at least clears that lot up, doesn't it? I'm looking forward to this commission." And I find that interesting, not only the fact of it happening, but the fact that he could tell me that it was happening. And so the process of getting these people lined up behind me for trials or as a sailor was important. And I did one more thing, quite artificially in a way. When we got out to Gibraltar on the way out, where we were going to work up at Malta, I laid on a series of competitions on board the ship, one of which was going to be the heaving line competition, because I was concerned with the sailors. And they all had their special heaving lines with weights of lead shot in the end and all the rest of it. And some of them even used lighter line than was usually allowed for heaving lines in order to throw it further. And to their immense surprise, because I'm coordinated, I won this competition. I took part in it with the sailors. And this, I think, probably did me more good with the sailors than many of the other things which I did, because I was known as a pretty fair strop when it came to the defaulters table, for example.
How did you treat the defaulters then?
Very strict rules for doing so in Queen's regulations as to what you were allowed to give them the way of punishment, what I was allowed to give them the way of punishment, and of course, if I felt that their case was such that it was a more serious one than I could deal with, I would say captain's defaulters, and they would, a captain once a week or something would hold his defaulters. Then I'd have to appear and say, this is why, in effect, I was prosecuting this particular chap. But we didn't have a great mass of defaulters. I think a lot of them really wanted to see the Far East and were interested in it. They were intrigued to have bunks and reading lights and so on, which they never had before. And the ship was really well fitted up. And now she's changed a lot alongside in your museum rig, in effect. You've kept some of the old ways of doing it, and indeed put some hammocks back in some places, I think, which is a good way of seeing how it's progressed.
Now, what was your accommodation like?
Until the captain turned up, it was very luxurious indeed, because I had the commander's cabin down aft, which had its day cabin and a night cabin and my own ablution facilities and so on. When the captain appeared and he took over the admiral's cabin, it was quite clear that by the time we got to the Far East, we were going to have flag officer second in command on board. And I knew then that with an admiral and the captain, I certainly wasn't going to live in this sort of luxury down aft. And so I had a cabin up on B Gun Deck, which is now used by the chap who runs the place for the museum. And I designed that cabin and indeed had the tilting bunk put in and all the rest of it, which is still there, I saw the other day. But I joined at such a time when the wardrobe, for example, had...
Now, what was the cabin like you had, and what was this tilting bunk?
The cabin which I helped to construct, I thought I'd be in it, was comparatively small. There was a desk to the after end, the right side of the door when I went in, a bunk which turned into a settee by day, was along the outboard bulkhead, and it was up on ex-gun deck. And the deck head was, in fact, open to the sun above me. And therefore, when I got out to the tropics, I found that it was the hottest. It was like living inside an oven. I had a wash basin. I was fairly close to the officers' heads and showers on that particular flat where the other officers, some of the other commanders lived, but in slightly smaller cabins than I had. And best of all, I had a leading steward of my own, leading steward Aupo Wah. And he was a very experienced, wizened Chinaman of about, indeterminate age, but I should think late 30s, early 40s, who devoted himself to my welfare in the most marvelous way I could possibly wish for.
Well, what would he do for you?
He brought me a cup of tea in the morning and woke me up and made certain I was up and about. But the most important thing he did for me was to establish a first-class relationship with the Admiral Steward and the Captain Steward, both Petty Officer Stewards. Admiral had a Chief Steward when he was on board. So that if, when we were in the Far East, I arrived in my cabin in the middle of the forenoon and found my best uniform laid out, sword and medals and all the rest of it, I didn't ask. I got into them as quick as I could because I knew that Aupo Wah would have had information from his chum, the stewards, in the Admiral Captain's cabin. And once or twice I caught it up and the captain didn't as a result of that. He was extraordinarily kind, extraordinarily hardworking, and not communicative at all. If I wanted a private dinner party out of the wardroom, I could seat four or five people in a table he somehow rigged in the flat outside my cabin. And he rather enjoyed doing that because he felt this was a good way for the commander. And I think it gave him face with the others. And he had a good relationship with Chief Petty Officer Kwok, who was the chief cook, wardroom chief cook. And Kwok had an amazing ability for making architecturally perfect cakes out of sugar icing. And with my youngest daughter's fourth birthday, which occurred just before we left, he insisted on making a cake which had flying buttresses and was indeed wired for electricity, so it had lights as well all the way through it, and went up to two or three stories of this thing. And it was so gorgeous, I didn't want to eat it, of course, and cut it. But when eventually we got it home and we did cut it and eat it, we found he was marvellous architecturally. We didn't much care for the cookie cake inside it.
What about the wardroom? You were about to wardroom, can you describe what it looked like and what it was like?
Access to the wardroom was through a screen door on quarterdeck level, just forward on the port side. On the starboard side is the wardroom mess, as opposed to the place where you had your meals, was on the port side. I had a problem on how to decorate it. I decided that I'd put the yellowish formica in there because it didn't show stains at all. You can clean it easily, and I see with interest it stood up all these years and it's still there. On the starboard side, we had polished mahogany tables for meals. And at the forward end of that part of the wardroom was the serving hatch to the galley. And the bar in the port side was at the forward end of the wardroom as well. And it was not over comfortable, but there were certain things I'd had fixed, furniture which I'd had fixed and upholstered, because you don't want things rolling about at sea if you can avoid it. And the chairs, we had facilities in the other part of the wardroom for securing those as well, in case in a seaway. But broadly speaking, it was perfectly good enough for what we wanted in every way without being luxurious. I was reasonably tight about sticking to wine bills and things like that, and we didn't have serious problems with most of the officers on board, although there was an occasion in the South China Sea when I had a problem. We'd gone with great hurry from Singapore to a freighter in trouble in the South China Sea with someone with appendicitis. And there was the fag end of a typhoon blowing. And we had to transfer this poor devil at sea across by Jacksday. And indeed, the doctors, we had a surgeon commander and a surgeon lieutenant on board. And we found the course where the ship was not railing as much as it might do on another course. And quite suddenly, I was down in the wardroom when the chief who looked after the doctoring in the ship came into the wardroom and said, "Excuse me, sir, I have a message from the surgeon commander for the barman." So I said, "What's all this about, chief? How's the operation going?" "Oh, well, sir," he said, "I think the surgeon lieutenant will be very happy for the surgeon commander to be able to get the bottle of whiskey I've been sent down for, because surgeon lieutenant feels he's done these appendix operations more recently than the surgeon commander. So we're going to give the bottle to the surgeon commander and he's going to get on with the operation." And so I agreed that that would happen, and the surgeon commander enjoyed his drink, and he was a very good storyteller, great fun to go ashore with. But I didn't have to do anything violent about drink, because they didn't get so drunk at any time that I was not prepared to accept it. But they did stick to the limits in their wine bills.
And what about the food? What kind of food did the officers get?
The Chinese cooks were first class, but they mostly cooked what they'd been taught in the RN cookery schools. So it didn't really vary very much from what one normally got, unless I insisted that I wished to have Chinese food cooked, perhaps if I was giving a party or something like that. And they really were excellent. When we got out to the Far East, I insisted that the slight profit we made through our cost of drinks should be invested in providing bottles of fresh lime juice on the bar always, which was free. So if people were really thirsty, they'd come in and have that at any time. The food there was as good as I'd had in most ships, and in big ships anyway, and was more flexible if one talked nicely to Chief and Elsa Quirk about what one wanted. The slight trouble with drink we had was in, I think it was in the Philippines.
I'll come to that.
Yes, we'll come to that.
Now, on the way out, how was the ship settling down? Because you were still a new ship.
She was settling down, I thought, rather well. The officers, seaman officers, were doing their stuff, I felt, rather well. One or two of the younger ones need to be directed or corrected a little bit, but nothing out of the ordinary at all. And I exercised them in all the things which we would have to do, towing or emergency boat, sea boat drill, etc. And I was aware that when we got to the Far East, we would also have to take part in a fleet regatta. And so I was very glad that when I heard that we had able to take part in a regatta at Malta, so I had the whalers' crews pulling away like mad, including officers' crews. Indeed, I pulled in one of the officers' crews myself. And we were building up enthusiasm to do these things. Malta was particularly interesting for me because the flag officer of Malta had been my commanding officer in HMS Tartar during the war, Admiral Tyrwhitt.
How was he?
Vice Admiral Tyrwhitt was couldn't have been more charming. He made a signal on our first weekend there saying, "Do come and have a banyan party with my wife and children in their barge." Had the most marvelous picnic with all his staff, of course. But I fear that probably my naval career ended as we got into Malta the first time round. I don't know why, and I can't prove it, but I think it was factual. I had to bring the ship's company to attention to salute the appropriate flags as you go in, and I either missed one or did something wrong anyway, and the captain took offense and tore me off a monumental strip in front of all the sailors around the bridge. And I duly apologized and so on. Then we were running a regatta, for a ship's regatta, and I think the stoker's crew beat the boys' crew by a narrow margin. And I'd had Chief and Elsa Kwok do a cake, which was an exact replica of a whaler, which he'd done most beautifully. And we cleared our deck so that the captain could present this cake to the winning crew down on the quarterdeck. And there were huge roars of applause for the stoker's crew and so on. And he duly presented it, captain, and said a few words, and then said, "Dismiss the ship's company, commander," and turned about and disappeared down his hatch to his cabin on the quarterdeck. So just as I drew breath to dismiss the ship's company, the coxswain of the stoker's crew took a pace forward. I said, "Yes, what was that?" He said, "My crew would like to give half the cake to the boys' crew because they did so well." So I said, "That's an extremely sporting gesture," announced it to the ship's company at the top of my voice. Three cheers for the stoker's crew, hip hip hooray. Then followed W.A. Smartly, and as I did that, the bell on the quartermaster's bell rang from the captain's cabin, commander to the captain's cabin. So I went down there, and he said, "What was that cheering, commander?" So I told him the story exactly the same way I told you. I was, you know, all hyped up with marvelous morale that they could do that sort of thing. And he went absolutely red in the face, and he said, "I'll have you know, commander, when I order you to dismiss the ship's company, you are to obey my orders." And in effect threw me out of his cabin. I found out several years later that he wrote an adverse report on me that night. And I was also found out a few years later that I was top of the Far East list for promotion the whole time we were out there. But I was passed over. So I became somewhat bitter and twisted afterwards about this when I realized just what had happened in practice. However, that's one of the hazards of the service, and I got another pension from Kodak instead, because I resigned from the service as soon as I was passed over. Now, on the way from, we worked up at Malta, and it was all terribly exciting. On the way from Malta to Suez, to Aden rather, we had to go down the Suez Canal, and I started a beard growing competition in the wardroom. And said that we would have a competition and we'd actually note at Singapore when we arrived there who had the best beard, and there would be a prize, and we all put in 5 shillings or whatever it was towards the prize. My own ability to grow facial hair is strictly limited, and I look as I've got a bad attack of mange apart from anything else. And so I was very happy to say that nobody could go ashore in Aden unless they shaved off, because they weren't properly hairy enough by then to be seen by the public anywhere. Certainly I wasn't. So I did go ashore in Aden. And we had on board, we took on board at Suez some Gully Gully men. Now, the Gully Gully men are the conjurers, Egyptian conjurers, who are totally brilliant at producing live chickens or eggs or whatever out of their pockets, out of your ears, apparently, out of your shirt. And they were doing this with the ship's company all around them on the forecastle. And I had sentries to prevent them from disappearing into the ship or barter going on with things that shouldn't have been bartered with them. And we really had the greatest fun going down the Suez Canal, because they took passage all the way down, and then we put them ashore on a boat, and they found their own way back, no doubt, in the next ship going north. But in Aden, they still haven't had the major rows which built up later, and we were out of it. But there were certain hesitations about going ashore, and we were warned not to go into certain parts of the city. So quite clearly the rows were building up, but we were there mainly to fuel before setting off across the Indian Ocean.
Did you go ashore?
I went ashore, yes, I shaved off and went ashore very briefly to have a swim at the club, I think, as much as anything else, and to meet some of the locals who, as usual, were feeling rather cut off. But going down through the masses and masses of sand with very big ships there, some of them having to secure alongside while you pass them. The impressions were quite staggering. I loved it, I must say, on the way out. I recorded at the time primitive mountains at the back of Aden and hot as H. Which it was very, very hot indeed.
How was the Belfast in these conditions? I mean,
I
know you have a story later on about when you closed down for nuclear. But
yeah, the wardroom was air conditioned. The bit on the port side, anyway, was air conditioned. And some of the other quarters were air conditioned. The ship's company dining hall, which was where the original port hangar was air conditioned. I can't remember all the parts which were, but there weren't a lot of them. But there was some air conditioning anyway. The heat, however, as we found out in the Mediterranean, and worse and worse as we went further into the tropics, did produce other horrors, and there was a likelihood that people got badly burnt in the sun as well. So we had to make it a disciplinary offence if anybody was incapable of doing their work due to sunstroke, because sailors like to strip off as far as they possibly could and go beetroot-coloured and then keel over, of course. And one had to teach the ones who hadn't been to the tropics before. That really wasn't the thing one did. But we did work up. The guns all worked.
How about the guns? How had the guns changed? I mean,
they hadn't. They were the same guns that I'd seen in my first ship, Sheffield. They were 6-inch, hydraulically loaded guns.
Had nothing changed?
Virtually nothing had changed about the weaponry. No, they were in turrets of 3 6-inch guns in each turret. You still had loader drill, which one did, with swabs and rammers. You may remember from the Napoleonic Wars, there was always a great worry that when you were ramming the next charge and wad into the barrel of a cannon, you wanted to make darn certain there wasn't anything burning on the end of the rammer, combined sponge and rammer, from the last time you'd done it. And so you left the thing in a bucket of water or something at the bottom of the gun. Exactly the same in these turrets. There was water, there was the combined sponge and rammer, and so on.
What other weapons did you have?
We had the 6-inch guns was the main armament, and we had 12 of those. We had the two twin four-inch on both sides, and so there were 8 4-inch guns, and there were some pom-poms.
Were they dual-purpose, anti-aircraft ship, or were they...
You could use them for surface, but they were primarily anti-aircraft guns, which would elevate right up to about 80 degrees, 70 or 80 degrees. And you would use them with star shell as well. And we did, in fact, exercise all of them in doing their thing.
Pom-poms, you said?
Pom-poms and... I think some Oerlikons, but I can't remember that for certain anymore.
And what about anti-submarine defense
Fortunately, it wasn't my prime concern in the ship, because there were virtually none, is the answer to that. You could hear torpedoes coming, perhaps, but you weren't designed to chase submarines. If you found a submarine, you left it as quickly as you could. At a time when I knew from my intelligence work there were submarines at sea which could go faster up sea than we could. But that didn't seem to have been promulgated all that wildly.
So nothing anti-submarine at all?
No, virtually nothing, no.
And you had torpedoes, I believe?
Yes, I believe we did. Well, not did certain.
Did you have anything to do with it?
No. Nope.